All right, if you're looking for entertainment, you clicked on the right podcast today. Some of you may have been skeptical, a little hesitant. A UFC fighter, who is this Dorian Price guy? Let me tell you, this is probably one of the craziest interviews we've ever done on this show. No hyperbole. Drake knows Dorian from his past in MMA. Now he ends up on our podcast. Please enjoy. Let's have a day. Let's go.
Welcome back, Watch the Walk-Ons fans, to another episode of the podcast. And this one's going to be pretty sweet for me in particular. And I think you guys are really going to like this one as well. We've stepped outside of the realm of football several times with different sports, but I've never brought you guys really into the world of mixed martial arts, especially mixed martial arts in other countries, because they do things a whole lot differently than we do here. Coach and I have talked about that many times, about the mentality of a lot of Americans as opposed to the foreigners in the fight game. And I think that hearing some of the coach's stories are going to be pretty eye-opening for you guys. So sit back and enjoy. Coach Dorian Price, welcome to the podcast, and thank you very much for joining us.
No, thank you guys for having me. I really appreciate it.
This is
Cooper, what do you got for him, dude? I know you got a question queued up. You've been thinking about it for a while.
I just feel like, so for those who are watching the podcast today, Drake's camera isn't working for some reason. So he is his better half today. It's just Kaylee on the screen. And I think it might be because Dorian probably had to deal with looking at your ugly face so much that the technology just was trying to help him out today. So no, I'm super excited to have you on, Dorian. This podcast, I don't know how much Drake has told you about it. It is sort of based on the genetics of, you know, we are kind of underrated, under recruited guys who ended up at a Division I football program and, kind of embodied a crazy work ethic, a great mentality to be better and be disciplined and just work through adversity. And I feel like a lot of that, and that's why Drake is so interested in the fight game in the first place, a lot of that transfers over to MMA and fighting in general. So I'm just extremely excited to hear your story and appreciative that you're here. I'd love to know, like, going all the way back, like, when was the first time that fighting was ever a thing for you? Like, was it something you wanted to get into very early on, or was it something that happened later in life, or how did that come about?
Well, martial arts was always like around. I'm 46 now. So when I was younger, we had, you know, Saturday used to be a thing called Kung Fu Theater. You used to have the old Kung Fu flicks on, and you had the Wu-Tang Clan, and so martial arts, and even our action heroes, or I should say my action heroes of the day, were guys like Chuck Norris.
Hell yeah.
Bruce Lee, you know, the guys, they were manly men, and they were all doing karate or some sort of martial arts, and that's what kind of got me interested in it. But growing up, I was playing basketball and doing other things. It wasn't until I turned, 18, I started, I ended up in Virginia Beach and was looking through. They used to have these magazines back in the day called Black Belt magazines. And in the back, they used to have these videos called Panther videos, in the VHS days, and the Panther videos. And inside, I saw a video, and this guy, because I had wanted to become a Navy SEAL. And so I saw one of this guy that was a SEAL, and he had cool videos. And then also, if you kept flipping through the through the Black Belt magazine, they would have the list of the states. And in the states, they would have the various gyms or whatever. And it just so happened that the same SEAL, called Mr. C, he was a... Virginia has a very large naval installation, and they have the East Coast SEAL team stationed there in Little Creek Amphibious Base. So I just happened to walk. I saw that his gym was in Virginia Beach, and I was like, I was on the other side of the water, which is called Hampton Roads. And I was like, man, this isn't far. So I just started driving down and walking to the gym. And the guy became like a mentor, and there were a lot of SEALs there. There was regular people as well. But that really shaped my mentality. And bought a couple times there. This is back in the 90s where there was no athletic commission. So you pretty much just, you know, you showed up and you fought. Yeah, then after that, I did my first stint in Thailand.
You, going all the way back to the very beginning of that, you said you're 46. You look better than most 30-year-olds. So that's,
I appreciate it. Inside, I'm probably 80.
80.
So coach, explain your first stint in Thailand. So, you know, you've been in martial arts a couple of years and you go over there. Explain the eye-opening experience that was.
It was very, very interesting.
Cause I've seen your videos on Instagram of you taking your followers through what it was like there. You've got videos of the trenches.
That would have been a long-term stint. So that would have been 2009 on up until 2020. So that's okay. What you're talking about.
Yeah.
First stint was the golden era. And it was pretty interesting. It was the golden era of Thai boxing, which is seen as like the legendary fighters. It was a lot harder. But I think you're talking about the second stint where I had all those fun videos.
Yeah, of how where you were staying, where you were going to the bathroom, showering at, what the living situation looked like.
Well, the different camps were different. So I always wanted to search out the knowledge, and I was really had the opportunity because I was one of the first Americans over there. And a lot of the camps, you know, they didn't really have too many foreigners and definitely not Americans. So I became the first foreigner and the first American at a lot of camps. And some of the conditions were, you just live like from one camp that I went to that always close to my heart is a camp called Sip Mon Chai, a very famous camp. And one of the things where they would have me sleeping on the floor. So, you know, a lot of times it's very communal. So it's like a family, almost like a Spartan-like environment when you think of a Thai boxing camp, very regimented. So the most camps just to give you kind of a layout, you live in the camp. Every camp has different living situations, but pretty much you're in a room. Sometimes you might have, if you're lucky, you got some bunk beds set up. If not, you're on the floor with just mattresses stuffed on the floor, never air con in the room. So it's a fan. And the way it runs down is pretty much, now mind you, every camp will be slightly different, but it's pretty much this is what it's kind of like. You wake up about 6 o'clock in the morning, brush your teeth, throw some water in your face, whatever you got to do. 6:30, you're on the road. You do your 10K run, which I think equates to about 7 miles. Come back. You'll probably train maybe 2 hours of actual training after the run. Then you jump your rope for 30 minutes. Then you do about 2 hours in the morning. Now, mind you, every camp is somewhat different. You'll eat, shower. They want you to be off of your feet. You know, you don't have to be asleep, but you're going to run. Maybe you can get up. You get up at maybe noon or something. There's always a rice cooker or one of the boys in the camp. They might know how to cook, so they might cook up a little food. So you can eat your third meal or something. Or excuse me, second. 3:30, 4 o'clock, depending on the heat of the day. You'll get out. You'll go run again. This time you're running 6K, which I think equates to 3 miles. I'm not too sure, but you'll run your 6K. You'll come back, and the afternoon session will be probably about 4 hours, and you'll do that 6 days a week. So you'll do it twice on Saturday as well. So your only off day is technically is Sunday, and it runs like that.
How many calories are you eating on these days?
I don't know. We don't count calories. I mean, I was able to get two meals a day was sufficient enough for me. Then I can get some fruit. There's always some of the camps, you know, they had coconuts around, so you could just go out there and knock a coconut off the tree and, you know, eat that. or just get some fruit. I never counted the calories.
That's insane. you're running almost 10 miles a day and have 5-6 hours of mat time, or like, what I guess
seven, depending on the camp. So in the morning you might do two, some camps are a little harder, maybe you do 3 hours of training. So it's anywhere between, let's just say, 6 to 7 hours a day, 6 days a week.
And eating two meals a day. That's insane. Mm-hmm.
Eating two meals a day. Yeah. And you can eat your rice and stuff.
That's, and did you ever feel run down or burnt out of that?
Me personally, I did not, because I just stopped. I didn't think about it. It became part of my routine, to the point where even when I retired, I remember I would get up, and that's another story in itself. I used to just get up, because I was still living in camp in retirement. I would get up and then start running. And then halfway through, I would just be like, what the fuck? Wait a minute. I'm retired. I don't have to do this.
It's like, hold on a second. I don't do this anymore.
What am I doing?
I would walk back to the camp, and I used to get like a rescue. Like, there are a lot of street dogs. So I would try and like keep bringing street dogs back to the camp. And eventually they had to tell me, like, look, man, you got to stop bringing these dogs back. So I would just come back and play with the street with what I call gym dogs. There was like 50 of them. And I was too lazy to name them. So I was just like gym dog one, gym dog two. I just give them random names.
When did you retire, Dorian?
I retired at 40. I think 40 was my last fight. Yeah.
Wow. And you still felt good at 40? Or no?
Fighting wise?
Yeah.
I felt like I could do it. What got to me was when I just realized that's when I probably started feeling sort of burnt out, because I never thought about anything. I never thought about the train or anything. And then the day I started thinking about, like, oh shit, I got to make the run, or I was like, oh man, it's the beginning of the end then.
Yep. Yeah. That makes sense. I have another question. Was there a language barrier over there, or did they know English?
There's always somebody can speak some English, but it wasn't too much. And the language of martial arts isn't really, it's pretty universal. It's like, sure. Hey, punch this motherfucker in the face. This would have kicked his ass, and, you know, do this and that. And, you know, you eventually figure it out.
That makes sense.
Did you have any run? I talked to a few guys that served in the armed forces and spent some time over there. And I've heard, did you spend any time like in the nightlife area out there? I've heard you got to be super careful about some of the maybe ladies that you're talking to over there.
Oh, lady boys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know the concept? Funny story. Do you know why they become lady boys?
No, I have no idea.
Because in Thailand, they think you lose face if you're just gay. They say, well, what are you doing? You're a liar. Just go all the way with it. So you also, they're like, don't just pretend. So they rather you just go all the way instead of pretending to be like being, I guess, gay. I guess that's how they look at it. They're like, I'm trying not to get you guys canceled here.
Oh, that was a long time ago.
Too late, man.
Okay, cool. Yeah, their thing is like, you know, fuck it. What are you doing? Just go all the way with it. If you want to be that way, then go all the way. Don't hide it.
All right. I kind of like it. All in. Interesting.
But I didn't really spend the, yes, the nightlife is around. A lot of the camps I were at were in the different places, somewhere in the mountainside, in the jungle, somewhere in the countryside, somewhere nice in beach areas. And it wasn't until what they consider Bangkok, or is this considered like the hunting ground, like that's where everyone wants to go to, for at least for fighting. I personally didn't like to train there necessarily, because running through the traffic, I like running in the mountains, in the country, or in the jungle. But you see the nightlife, but surprisingly, you don't see them around all the time. It's kind of like if you're into that nightlife thing, you'll run into them more, but they have their like certain districts. And for me, I didn't really want to partake in that, because that's what I was there for. I was there for the sole purpose of inflicting violence. And as a foreigner, and I knew I carried, for some situations, being that I was one of the Americans over there, the first Americans to really, you know, myself and another friend of mine, Cyrus Washington, we were really, so in my mentality, I was like, look, I don't need to fuck this up, because I'm not going to give America a bad rep, because if I fuck this up, I might close the door on some other people. So I knew I had a sort of responsibility to say, like, look, I mean, this, you know, I want to open the door for other Americans to come over. So for me, I had a little bit more of the discipline part. Like, so I,
yeah, that's
sometimes go out, but, you know, I didn't really partake in a night like too much.
Yeah, I love that out of you, though.
That's fairly incredible forward thinking by you, and sounds very mature, especially for someone who, you said you went over there at 18, or when did you go over there at first?
Yeah, I was, I think I was 18, 19. I just turned 19, maybe.
What was the connection to Thailand? Was there somebody you knew who had been over there, or someone who helped you get over there into those camps?
Well, you have to remember, when I was born, so 1976, I think we brought the last troops back from Vietnam in 73. I think the war technically ended. So I had a lot of family that was in Vietnam, and they would do a lot of their R&R in Thailand. So it wasn't a foreign concept. Like, it was funny. I would have uncles that would tell me, like, yeah, I went to this place, and they do this sort of fancy karate. And I was like, what the fuck? And like, yeah, some fancy karate. And they would tell me about it. And so it wasn't, Southeast Asia was not a foreign concept to me coming up. I just never really, you know, I was into other sports. So when I got over there, that's a funny story, because I remember I had a fight against a guy in New York. And I remember it was a VHS, so I had brought it back. And it was on my granny's house for Thanksgiving. And I remember I was showing it to all my uncles and my father at the time. And all they were doing was, they were just making fun of me. They were like, why are you turning your back? Why you look tired? And they were like, that's because he smoked weed. He ain't serious. And then they just kept making fun of me. I remember I took the VHS tell, I smashed it on the floor and broke. And I was like, man, fuck all y'all. And they were just laughing. And then they were like, why don't you go over there and beat up on them little Asian people? Go over there. You over here beating up on somebody from, where you from? Brooklyn. You beating up on that. If you want to really be the man, go be the man on that block. You know, and that really stuck with me. So what ended up happening, it was a gift from my father. He took me over there and left me, because I remember we got to the hotel and I was like, man, this is nice. And I was like, oh, but they messed up. There's one bed. And he was like, oh, no, buddy. This is your dream. I'll see you later, boy. He's like, the flight, your return flight leaves at such and such time. Good luck. I was going. I had money saved, low money saved up, working job and stuff.
And hold on a second.
I never saw him again. He did what he had to do. And I remember I went through the kitchen staff and I started asking, like, hey, I know how to say Nak Muay, which is like Thai fighter. And I would make the gestures of like punching. And I was like, hey, I want to go find a gym. And so I started walking around Bangkok. And then some of the gyms, they were like, my me for long, which is like, we don't want nothing to do with foreigners. And I was like, oh, fuck, what am I going to do? And so I just went back to the kitchen. Now, mind you, it's the morning time, so I, you know, it wasn't like pitch black night when he threw me out. But so I found one guy who was in the kitchen staff. I guess he was a former fighter. He wrote something on a, like, a index card kind of thing. He wrote something on there, and he was like, give it to this, go outside and give it to the cab. He spoke Brooklyn English. So I remember I went outside, gave it to this, it was in Thai, so I gave it to the guy. He drove me 3 hours out to a place called Patum Thani, and to a gym there. And I gave him the money I had. He took me in, and that was it.
You just trusted this guy to drive you 3 hours? You have no idea where he's taking you?
No idea. I mean, he could have slaughtered me for all I know. I just like, man, I got
to do this. Holy fucking shit.
Told y'all were in for a ride, man.
The Dorian...
happened. It could have ended horribly. I mean, he could have put my, you know, he'd been a cannibal for all I know, put my head on a stake or something to fillet my body. I don't know. My father told me before he died, he's like, hey, he's like, I would leave. I was like, all right, I found somewhere. He's like, all right, well, get your shit and go. And I was like, because he let me leave my bag. He's in the room. All right, man, go ahead, man. I got business to take care of. Get your shit and go on out there. And he was like, oh, by the way, he's like, I don't know if you know this, don't get locked up in third world countries, because shit might not be bad. This shit could be bad for you. And that was it. Didn't see him. He did what he did, and I stayed over there.
Wow, this is
that was the first thing as a teenager. So yeah,
that's a wild story. But also, this is just one of many common instances in the people that Drake introduces me to. Drake is just like built like you and you're Drake's kind of people, so this makes sense that you guys.
That's my boy. I love him, man. That's my bro. That's my bro.
I'm glad somebody does, because I don't. I don't even know where to go from there. So
talk to. I want to hear about your impression of Drake when Drake started training with y'all. Like, what was your first impression, and how has he come along in the fighting world through your eyes?
He's a monster. He's an absolute savage. I mean, he's going to do whatever he wants to do. I mean, athletically wise, I mean, his desire to learn and discipline. I mean, all the things that made him, you know, a great football player and to help him achieve what he got. I mean, you can see it in the martial arts. So the sky's
are we going to see our boy succeed in the ring sometime, you think?
Absolutely. Whatever he wants to do, he's going to succeed at. Whatever he wants to do.
I hate hearing that.
Appreciate you, Coach.
I'm glad I can't see your face, Drake. Drake's gifted. He has some talents. He told us about, so you're in Nashville right now.
Hell no.
Not anymore.
No. I'm in DC okay. Right now. I'm originally from Baltimore, Maryland.
Okay. Once he started up with jiu-jitsu and doing all this stuff, it seems that he comes back every month or so with some cool new guy he's met or some new coach or somebody got to roll with. And this is just another one of those experiences. So this is really awesome.
Hey, it's Peter Harmon, the food guru, here to talk about Gray's Gourmet To Go. At Gray's Gourmet To Go, we are madly and passionately in love with three things: chicken lips, pizza, and great food to go. Chicken lips are the most beloved food in Iowa City. And if you don't know what a chicken lip is, you're really missing out. Our second passion is pizza. We're hell-bent on making great pizza. Yeah, you can get cheap pizza anywhere. But if you're a real pizza aficionado, you gotta try our meatball pizza. It's made with a natural starter. And like sourdough bread, it's soft and crispy and light as air. And the third thing that we're wildly and passionately in love with is great food to go. We believe you want to feed your family something great at home, but you're too busy with life to stop and cook. That's why we built Gray's Gourmet To Go. So the next time you need to feed the gang and you don't feel like cooking, just come to graysgourmettogo.com.
So you start training in Thailand. You're a young kid. Mm-hmm. What is, at that point, what's the biggest, where's your biggest gap? Like, is there a day early on where you're like, holy smokes, I am light years behind these people?
I was humble enough and real enough with myself to understand that, you know, there was going to be a huge, gap because of the fact that, you know, the ties that they start at the ages of eight. A lot of times they'll leave their village, and, if they show promise and they'll go and start fighting to make money, for their family. So a lot of times by the time they're 16, if they don't have about 100, 150 fights, they're not really considered a prospect. And their prime is only technically from 16 to maybe 22. It's getting a little older now because humans are living longer, but mostly that's when they consider like the prime, what they call the stadium years, which is about 16 to 22.
Wow.
So I knew it was the gap. And then the clinching was the biggest thing, because their level of clinching is just incredible. I got a story of there was one camp I knew that they would clinch. So it's almost like a form of like wrestling, but like what you can knee, you can elbow. Of course, you're not elbowing in the training, but you can. We play with the elbows, but not like the severity of in a fight. But we knee and clinch and. Just getting thrown on my head left and right. And one of the stories, so this would be on my second stint there was a camp, and what they would do is they have, a lot of times you have water buffaloes, and water buffaloes are part farm animal, part pet for some of the villages. And the boys would clinch in the camp, and then what they would do is they would get out of the ring after clinching, and they would start grabbing the buffalo by the horn and start trying to move it, and it's playing with them, and they don't realize they're actually getting stronger. So they would clinch with you, and they would hop out the ring, and they would go over to the water buffalo, and they would start like playing around with it. And the buffalo would just move his head. They're very docile animals, move his head. So literally, they're literally getting like strong. And then the way they would, the coconut trees, they'd actually climb the trees. I mean, you can't see me, but they like put their feet and hands on the tree and they push themselves up. And just living like that, I think, makes them like a lot stronger. And then training in the heat and things like that, like I got a lot stronger over there.
How hot is it on an average day over there?
Depending on what part of the country you're in, I'd say obviously the jungle, the countryside gets hot. I'd say average, maybe 80, but some days it can feel like it's 100 something with, you know, all 100%
humidity.
Yeah, 100% humidity.
Well,
there was one camp with a guy trying to make put space heaters in there to make it hotter. He would close it off. Christ. Most of them are over, and he would close it off to make it hotter. So that was always funny.
Oh, man, all you fighter, wrestling, martial arts types guys, y'all are freaking nuts. Y'all know that?
They're built different.
Man, just got to love what you do. That's all.
I hear that. Did you learn how to climb a coconut tree yourself? Could you go do it?
I did learn, but then I got smart and realized, wait a minute, I just take one of these bamboo sticks and knock the shit down myself. It'd be a lot easier than breaking my neck trying to get up there. So I use my brain power.
There you go.
That's, fuck, this is Drake, when you started
tell them about, hold on, Clue, tell them about the, tell them about the fight schedule that you have over there, the frequency of fights.
You'll fight. Okay. So as kids, I mean, I think the most I did in 1 week was three, you'll fight on a regular basis, especially as kids. So you might fight let's say somewhere in the morning time on a Saturday. Then they'll check you, the big boss, or look to see if anything's busted up or anything, and then you'll go fight in the nighttime. So kids might fight four times in a weekend. They actually have a festival in the Tide, which is their version of New Year, because Thailand is actually on a different calendar than we are. So I forget. I think the year is 26 something now. But their New Year, they in a place called Isan, which is where a lot of the fighters come from. So think of Isan like New England. It's a lot of different provinces and places inside of there. Mm-hmm. In a place called Buriram, they'll have a festival where they'll set up a ring. You'll have referees and things like that, and there'll be actual fights. And sometimes you can fight drunk. Maybe the refs are drunk, and they're actually real fights. And you just fight. Maybe you can fight four or five times on the day.
Jesus Christ!
Did you ever partake?
No, I never went up there. I wish I did, because a lot of boys would come back, and we would always joke with them. We'd say, "Hey, how many fights did you have?" And they'll say, "Oh, you know, I had five fights, or I had seven fights." And
people
so
are drinking the shit.
And are they getting paid for all of these?
That's just like a labor of love. But for the other fights, we get paid. But you have to think, you have to look at it like, in a lot of ways, for the Thais, it's like being a racehorse. So you can get traded. For instance, if I'm the big boss of a camp, and this isn't always the case, but if I'm the big boss and you're a big boss, well, I could bet you and say, okay, I bet you 28,000, which is used US dollars, 28,000 and my fighter wins. You could say, okay. But if your fighter wins, you could then say, and not only do I get the money, but I get your fighter as well. And then, so my fighter has to then come to your camp, and he'll take the last name of your camp. And that's very common. That's common. It's not always the case, because you can.
So if you're the fighter and you lose, you just don't get much of a say. Like, otherwise, you're getting kicked out of your home camp or what?
Not kicked out. You just might go to the other camp.
I mean, traded, Kevin. Like, traded.
Yeah, traded almost. I mean, but you have to, it's not always the case. You know, I could always say, because fighters are always bought, and then you could say, look, I want to buy your fighter. So you'll see fighters fighting under a lot of different last names. Like sometimes you might see my name being Dorian Sipmonchai or Dorian Kalpatek or Dorian Lukpabad. It could be different names for the camp you're fighting on. Now, it's not very common for, as foreigners, we're not upheld by the same rules as Thai people, obviously. But yeah, you could just say, hey, I want to buy that fighter. How much? And now you might say, oh, it's $100,000. Let's just say $100,000 or whatever for the time effort I spent building them up, whatever the case. So I give you that, and then he comes on over to my camp, takes my last last name of my camp, and he goes and he fights.
So like there's obviously fights all the time.
Yeah,
going everywhere. Is this like Thailand's most popular sport, would you say?
Yeah, it's a national sport. They fight 7 days a week. At any given time, there could be
Do all the young kids grow up like learning how to fight and stuff?
A lot of it's a weird dynamic because it'll work like this. If it is the national sport, but if a kid comes from money, you'll see their family will put them in Taekwondo or they'll go into boxing because those are Olympic sports. And, you know, it's more prestige winning a gold medal than just doing Muay Thai. They still kind of view Muay Thai as it's changing now with, you know, the global recognition that the sport is now getting.
But shout out ONE Championship.
Yeah, the ONE's doing great things. It's seen as it was always seen as like a poor man's sport, even though it was the national sport. But if you are came from money, you would want to put your child into Taekwondo or boxing in hopes of going to the Olympics. But it's not rare for most of these guys, the fighters. Yeah, it's not rare to find fighters with 500, 600. I think the record is 900, but he said he lost count.
I mean,
I would too.
Jesus.
Enough times, yeah, you probably lose count pretty easily.
Because you fight, you're in a perpetual state, and you want to fight. You're doing all the training, and you don't want to, like, sit around there. There's a point where you want to fight. Like, I think I would get maybe 3 weeks to maybe a month if I had a really big fight, which was, you know, good. I wouldn't want any more time than that to get ready for a fight because you're in a perpetual state of readiness. I mean, you're training all the time. You don't want to just keep doing that. At some point, you get to the point where, look, man, I want to fuck somebody up for all this. So you want to fight at some point.
I hear that. I mean, that's playing football. That's like one of the things that I dislike most about the sport is, you know, the practice to play ratio is just is horrible, right? You get to play college football 12 games a year max, right? So I'm curious, like, all these fights going on, like, on a local, your local gym on a Tuesday night, how many people are from the town are showing up to these fights? Is it like a big affair every night? Like, that's what you go to dinner, you go watch the fights, or what?
Depending where you are. And for instance, on Sundays, there are times where a lot of fighters will in the village, like, they'll stop and there are always fights on TV. So they'll watch like the big fights and stuff on Sundays, being at like the original Lumpini. They'll watch now that there's the ONE FC. They'll watch those type of fights because there's gambling going on all the time. But you might have smaller venues, like in the village or little stadiums like that, and they'll, you know, maybe go to that. But it just depends on where you are. But yes, for instance, when I retired, I started working as a commentator for a show called Max Muay Thai. And at one point, we were the most popular show around. And we had fights 7 days a week. And I purposely lived down in walking distance from the stadium. And you just getting a... Because I ended up going, that was my actually retirement fight. And I was invited to a camp there, and it was by invitation only. So the gym didn't even have a fucking address. I mean, it was just, you had to fight on Max. It was invitation. There was no website. There was no way to come there unless you were invited. So that was interesting. So we'd always have we were actually a sponsored gym for Max. So we all were contracted to fight on the Max show. So it was, it was pretty fun. Like the guys, you know, when we have fights, we all just go down to the stadium, and that's kind of how it works out. Like if you're near one of the big stadiums, like Bangkok, you know, everybody's coming out to watch. So I guess kind of where you're at.
So you were there, you said, from 2009 to 2020.
Yes, right at the start of COVID.
And the first time you were there, back when you were 18, lasted how long?
That was a 7 month stint.
So that was a small time.
Very small, very small. Yeah, because I had to come back with obligations in the U.S.
What? So how many total fights did you have when you were over there?
Jeez, I don't remember. It's quite a bit.
Hundreds.
No, I didn't get the 100 mark. But total, I only have
dozens. 80.
Yeah. It was a good amount. I think the most I had in 1 year was, I want to say 20, maybe.
So it really doesn't take, or at least for you, or for, I guess, for all of, if that's just kind of the culture of the sport over there, is like the recovery for this. It doesn't take much. It either doesn't take much to recover, or you're really good at recovering, or you just don't give a shit and you just fight.
No, your body hardens. And that's one of the things the big boss, you know, they were really good about. Your body hardens. The more you fight, and obviously you're going to fight with a sense of IQ. So it's not so much like what you're used to seeing in the UFC or things where guys are, I consider the striking level relatively low. It's starting to rise a little bit now, but you're fighting with IQ. So you're not really just throwing wild stuff or just smashing your bones into other guys. Like you have technique with it, but through all the rigorous training, the bag work, the pad work, your body does actually harden, and your bones calcify. Everything gets harder. And I believe, don't quote me, but I think it was called, it's called Wolf's Law. Like your body will adapt to the stressors that's placed upon it. So for instance, like you guys playing football, your body does harden to the sport of football. Whereas if I was to go out and play football, my body would probably break in half because it's not conditioned to the trauma that's required to participate in that sport. For my sport, my body was hardened for the trauma. For instance, I do jujitsu. I feel like I took 10 fights, 10 Thai fights from doing jujitsu because my body.
I go to one Thai practice and I feel like I just went through 10 fights.
Yeah. See, your body's conditioned for jujitsu where mine is not. But then if you were to come, when you come to Thai boxing, my body is conditioned for that. So your body conditions for the event you put it under. And also, you, things are within reason. Yes, there are times where, and that's how you develop your IQ. What I, you know, I had a really smart big boss named PA from Sipmunchai. And like, there would be times I'd break my hand. Well, I would still go fight. And you just don't use that hand. So you learn how to develop your other weapons. Or maybe my shin would be hurt. Because when I first went over the second stint, I actually lost my vision and I never regained all of my vision back in my eye. So I learned how to develop sort of an elbow thing because I couldn't really see good out of one eye.
And that's still something you deal with right now, is a vision loss?
Oh, it's not coming back. Yeah, because whatever happened, it got some sort of infection in it. And by the time I got it fixed, it had already done its damage. So it's not blind in it, but it's very, like, if I close one eye, it's very difficult. It's just fuzzy. But it was no problem.
Dorian, that sounds like a problem. A little bit, if I'm being honest.
Nah, that's part of the game. Because after I couldn't see. I remember I lied to get onto the, there was a big fight in the Philippines, and I needed money. I had no more money from the money I saved coming over there. And I was like, well, fuck, I got to fight. And there just so happened to be a spot they were looking for in America. It was a four-man tournament. And I remember they were asking me, the people at the camp, like, can you see? I was like, oh, yeah, I'm fine. Then I remember I turned to my buddy, like my trainer. He's like, "Can you see?" I was like, "No, man, I'm blind as shit, man, in this eye, man, it's fucked." And he was like, oh, "Okay." And so I was like, "Yeah, I'm taking this fight." So I went over there. I just remember lying to the guy. I was like, "Man, I see perfectly. Everything's fine. Let's go."
You are a crazy son of a bitch. Unbelievable.
In the fight, the guy fucked up my good eye. So I was like, "Oh, you motherfucker!" It was a 4-man tournament, and he stopped me in the second round. I was like, "You motherfucker! How are you gonna swell my good eye?" The funny part of that story is my face is swollen and everything. It was a Chinese thing doing a show. And also, if we ever invade China, I got a beef with them. I'm going over. Them motherfuckers going to see me again.
motherfucker's going to see me again.
But that's another story. I won't go down that rabbit hole. But down the Philippines, I go there. And when I'm going to the airport, I remember before you go into the Philippines, you and into their airport, you have to go through security. You know, I don't know if they changed it, but you have to go through security before they get into the airport. So you put your stuff on the conveyor and all that. So I just had all my pesos, the Filipino currency, and put it on there. And I remember these military people are like, oh, they saw that. My face swole. It looked like I just got mugged. And then I remember going through the metal detector. They see me. They called me over. And they were like, oh, you have drugs in your bag. I was like, yeah, all right. I know, man. How much is this going to cost, man? Like, I'm hip to the game. I was like, how much? So I gave them the money. Then they gave me my money back because you have to pay a tax to leave the Philippines. So they took my money from the fight. And then I remember as I got back, I was like, hey, man, you motherfuckers got to give me a fight in like 2 days. And so I got another fight and fought a guy. Because in the provinces, there's no weight classes. So I fought a guy that was 205 pounds. I weighed about maybe my fight weight was 158. So I probably maybe weigh 165.
There's no weight classes?
in the provinces. You show up. So maybe the guy is, maybe he's good. Maybe he's not good. Maybe he's a former champion. Maybe he's not. You know, you don't know. You show up, and that's how you make your name. So you fight in the provinces. That's what I was doing in the gyms in Bangkok. They start to hear about you if you're doing right, and then you make a name, and then you go to Bangkok and these bigger shows where there'll actually be weigh-ins and weight classes. But in the provinces, you just kind of you show up, because Thai boxing, there's one thing about it which I love, and the Thais will say this. Sometimes they don't care about winning or losing. They'll actually put you in a fight sometimes where you don't really have a chance to win. And all they care about, they just want to see your courage. And I asked them about it, and they said, the trainer's like, yeah, you can always give a man skill. You can never give a man heart. So if you show you have heart, they can do something with you. But if you can give a man all the skill in the world, but if he has no heart, it doesn't matter. And they won't waste their time. They'll be very nice because they're friendly and they're great people, and they'll be nice, but why would they waste their time and invest in you? So a lot of times, that's what they say all the time. No problem, as long as you fight with heart. There are fights that I've lost, and I was sad, but they were so proud that I fought with heart and courage. And there are fights where I won, and they were like, you know, kind of like, hey, what the fuck?
They only
care about courage. It's an interesting thing.
I'm going to write that down. A skilled pussy isn't worth anything.
There you go.
Yeah.
You pay a hooker to leave, don't you?
That's good. That's good. So you were fighting at the top level eventually?
Eventually I did. I mean, I'd say my career is, you know, being honest, was like somewhat spotty a lot of times, because I would fight a whole lot and then I would like take a break and then, you know, do whatever. Maybe I'd go to Australia or somewhere else. I ended up getting caught up in, I got a really good friend. It's like my brother, you know, a guy named by the name of Matt Brown. And
shout out the Immortal, dude.
Yeah, love Matt, man. And he's done a lot for me as a coach career. So when he would have fights, he would actually, you know, hey, you know, it started off, we were just friends, and he saw I, and I had some skill and you know, more than anybody else around, honest talent. He was like, hey, why don't you start, you know, we were just friends. So he would like, hey, come back. And I never thought of myself as his coach. I was like, hey, this is my friend. Loyalty is important to me. You know, he was doing, I was like, man, you know, you're going to do great things in this. So he would bring me back from Thailand a lot of times. So I ended up getting kind of, I don't want to say forced, but like he, I guess, saw something in me that I didn't see in myself with the coaching thing. So sure. I did fight at the high level eventually, but I could have done better had I not gone back to coach. Okay. And things like that, because people started recognizing I had a talent for or an ability to relay the information in such a way to help people improve. And with Matt, and coming back with Matt, he was showing some of my style. We helped invent a clinch. So I don't, you know, so I a lot of my fights, what they would call muay wak, where you like kind of like temple fights, smaller fights, but they're raw because, you know, sometimes you only have to wear a mouthpiece. Then I would start fighting in the Lumpini, which was considered the Mecca. And when that kind of closed down, it broke my heart, because I really was making a big name in that stadium in Bangkok. So, yeah, I fought at the high. I got to the high level, but a lot of my career, fought in Europe and things. But a lot of my career was, you know, kind of spotty, because I would also come back to help guys. And people started seeing me more as a coach a lot of times. They really like, I guess, the way I relate information.
Talking to you right now, I I'm a fitness coach, and
okay,
you know, it's not the same thing, but coaching, there is one, and we had a lot of great coaches when we played football, and the biggest thing about coaching is someone who's great at doing it isn't always great at coaching it, because there's that,
correct,
there's you have to relay that information in a way that the person learning can understand it, and connecting with certain individuals, certain athletes, certain players, they all learn differently. So you have to be able to figure that out. And just communicating with you right now, it feels like you are really good at speaking and kind of relaying information. So it feels like you would be a great coach, in my opinion.
That's the product of the people I was around. So I can't take credit around for all that, because I was, you know, blessed to be around great coaches. Going back to my first instructor, Mr. C, the Navy, so I was talking about, just they really shaped me, because they say, like, I believe you have in this world is you have when you become a fighter, you experience two births and two deaths. So you have your birth with you come into this world. And then when you embark on this journey to be a fighter, you have another birth. And then eventually, you know, that will come to an end. Hopefully, you know, that dies before your life dies, you know, thing. So my birth into this was, you know, being around the SEALs and military people. So they really shaped me a lot in terms of if anybody's had the pleasure to be around special forces people, you can just see they have such an attention for detail. And that attention to detail instilled in me as a young kid, because I was just a young punk, but that instilled that attention for detail, attention at being honorable and things like that. Though those are the life lessons that what I think a martial artist should embody. And the things that they would see, the drills that they would give me, I used later on in my life, later in my career. But from there to being having the instructors I had in Thailand, to my sensei in Holland, I've been very, very for even to the guy I'm working with now, the guy by the name of Master Lloyd Irvin. You know, just being around these people was what has shaped me. And in a lot of ways, being around a guy like Matt Brown, you know, having such a good friend like him, he shaped me a lot of times too, because part of it is I had to become humble. And being humble, I thought I always consider myself humble, but humility has helped me learn more than anything, knowing that, okay, I don't know everything. So being willing to, that's what I say. If I was Matt's coach, I don't think I would have been as good. But being willing to say, if Matt says, hey, look, if you show me this tie clinch this way, but look, I've been going to the Ohio State wrestling room and, you know, we're doing this. So if I try to tie away against a good wrestler, they're just going to do this and this. So I was like, okay, let's play with it then. So we would experiment to the point where we started inventing our own clinch and things like that. Or, hey, I saw this way of doing something. And Matt's a very, very intelligent individual. I saw this way of doing it. Or a guy showed me this type of kick. And he would actually take me around to a lot of places. So I got the opportunity to get into a lot of rooms. Like I remember once he was living in Colorado and he went to the Olympic Training Center. And because we knew a guy from Ohio State University, and he was over there at the wrestling room. So I was like, hey, I'm going to come with you too. So I would go and, you know, learn and pick other people's brains. So I guess that sort of empty the cup sort of mentality is what would help me becoming a coach. But I'm still learning to be a coach, if that makes sense.
Sure. So I get it. It sounds like where you're supposed to be to me.
Okay.
And it's cool to listen to you talk about it. I have only one more question, then I'll let these other guys. I want to go back to the training just for this in general, specifically over in Thailand. Did they focus on any sort of recovery in those, like when they would have you get off of your feet, was there anything specific other than just kind of being off of your feet that would help you recover from sessions, recover from those long 6 mile, 3-4 mile runs, day in, day out? Or was it just really kind of like, again, the body hardening, you just kind of got used to it?
Well, remember, they have if you ever experienced like Thai massages are not like those sensual massages. They're painful and okay. They're actually stretch you at the same time that you're getting the massage. And yep. So a lot of times, one, your body's warm because you're essentially training in a sauna. The other thing is all the showers, like for instance, except there was one camp where there was no shower. We just had to use a bucket, like a trash bin to bathe out of.
Cool.
But most of the time, the garden hose, whatever we're using in the shower, the water's cold. Mm. So you're always taking like a cold sort of shower regardless. There was no hot water really. And so we would get massages.
How often?
Whenever you need it. Like it's sometimes like the best massage where I got with from the, it was like the blind, they were like these blind people and then they knew how to find every, they were like massive. It was so painful. I once had to wear my mouthpiece.
Wow.
Because the Thai massage, it stretches you at the same time it massages you. Sure. So they'll do a lot of that, but
how do you feel afterwards though?
As rest and recovery, because our strength and conditioning really was just when you're trying to move another human being in the clinch, you're getting stronger. But what we do is we do a lot of pull-ups, push-ups, dips, sit-ups, you're responsible, and then actually just hitting the bag, which were not we couldn't fill the bag like this in the Western world because somebody will go to jail. So they're filled very hard, very dense. You're doing a lot of pull-ups, a lot of dips, a lot of sit-ups. And
never really touch weights, did you?
You would have, for instance, there might be a a barbell. We took like one camp. We had like these little paint things and we filled it with concrete and put like a pole on the damn thing. Rusty as shit. And you would just do a lot of reps for that. Maybe you just do 100 of them. You do upright, do whatever.
Hell yeah. But
what we think of as strength and conditioning is not so much, because they were more focused on the technical aspect of it, of being technical and developing your power and things like that. We would do, because we run long distances very slow. What the misconception is, we never ran those long distances for cardio. We just strengthen our legs. Our cardio would come when we would smash pads, or our cardio would come at the end. We would do wind sprints after the end of practice. We would, you know, do wind sprints. But strength and conditioning is starting to develop now as the ties and more foreigners are starting to come over, more Westerners are coming over, introducing strength and conditioning things. As more ties are starting to fight and travel abroad, they're starting to bring this stuff back. But I'd say that the rest and recovery concept, the strength and conditioning concept is still at a lower level compared to where it is in the Western world. So it's starting to come up.
Cool answer. Over
there, reality is kind of like, just don't be a pussy. Like, motherfucker, fight. Like,
I got that over the course of you describing all this. I don't think I'd be cut out for all the stuff you're explaining. So I'm glad it was you, not me. Kevin, Grant, Drake, you haven't said a fucking word. I've been soaking all this up myself. So you guys jump in with whatever you got.
Go ahead, Kev.
What, you've obviously been exposed to a few different martial arts. Is Thai, Muay Thai your favorite, or do you got a one that speaks to you more than any other?
And don't lie and tell them that jiu-jitsu ain't really creeping up on your heart.
No. I love jiu-jitsu. I love it because it's something you can do for the rest of your life.
Yep.
Whereas Muay Thai, at some point, you know, it has to end, even in terms of like going out there playing around. Now, for sure, I could clinch forever, but jiu-jitsu is such a, for me, I like jiu-jitsu because jiu-jitsu is confusing to me. Muay Thai was always easy for me. The clinching, the things, the way my brain worked and trying to solve the puzzle, but jiu-jitsu has always been a puzzle. It's hard for me, you know. I'm still only a purple belt, but I like it because it's never ending. It's challenging, and for whatever reason, like at times it becomes very frustrating. So I very much like it. Like, I've always been a fan of jiu-jitsu, of wrestling. Even though I wasn't a wrestler, I've been a fan of those. But yeah, Muay Thai was always in my heart. And one of the reasons it was where it wasn't MMA is because I had two brothers. One brother passed, and I had made a promise to him, like I was going to go I had been to Thailand, so I come back. I was like, look, man, I'm going to, you know, go fight in Lumpini and all and do that. So that's why I wanted to, like, never really cared about MMA. Because I want to make sure that as a man, I always fulfill my promises. So I don't know if that's longer answer than you were looking for.
No, that's awesome, man.
Answers are great. Yeah. G-Bone, you got anything?
Great. You got to ask him a question, dog.
Yeah. So I'm curious, you've been involved in martial arts for a really long time. So compared to when you started to now, what's the biggest kind of, outside of just popularity, what do you feel like is the biggest change in the sport? And then as like a follow-up, like a part two to the question, where do you think the sport is in 20 more years from now?
I say at the athletes, with the strength and conditioning and the kids are starting, even in the Western world, the kids are starting younger. They're like, I think we have yet to see right now your best athletes are going to go to football, or they're going to still gravitate towards basketball.
Mm-hmm.
I think 20 more years, we're going to see a freak athlete who should be like a, I don't know how, Javon Kirst. Do we remember who he is?
Oh yeah.
A freak athlete like that, or LeBron James. I think we might see one of those guys start martial arts and end up in MMA, you know, as opposed to on that path of ending up in the NFL, ending up in the NBA. So
that'd,
I think,
cool.
20 years. I hope the money will allow that to happen. And I'm sorry, the other part of the questions?
That, you know, you answered it.
Yeah.
No, I think that's pretty much it. Go ahead.
I was going to say, do you see like some of those tall, lanky basketball players being able to have success at like 6'8" plus, like in the martial arts game?
For sure. Yeah. In NBA, there's a guy in, I think it's PFL. He's pretty tall.
Stefan Struve was 6'11".
Stefan Struve, Semi Schilt from Holland was actually 7 feet. Wow. You have Tim Sylvia was tall. You have, so you have guys now athletic wise, you have a new guy now named, Jamal Hill. He was I think basketball player. And, our buddy Derek Overstreet was a
defensive end at Western Kentucky.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, he was coming. I mean, he was a new type of breed like that. And then you have Drake. So you have these guys that are starting to come now. I mean, you know, I just think in 20 more years, you know, instead of them coming after their careers are over, they're going to that career. They're going to start and then progress and just go all the way.
Yeah.
The money will go. The downside of that is, I think what's happening is with social media, we're losing a lot of the warriors, like the battle hardened guys, like the Matt Browns, the these grizzly veterans. Because I personally think society's getting softer, really soft.
We can agree on that.
We have a hard fucking time. You know, I mean, we're still trying to figure out what the fuck a man and a woman is. I mean, that's pretty fucking simple.
I mean, it's simple as shit, ain't it, Coach?
Yeah, I mean, it's unbelievable to me. But we now we done figured out, and we done added 15 other fucking genders. I'm confused and shit. You know, I'm not the sharpest pencil in the box, but get, fuck, man. Like, can we keep it simple? So I recently learned, like, pretty much my entire childhood has been canceled. Al Bundy and Married with Children was gone. Pretty much all the shows I grew up watching pretty much were all canceled now. So I think as society, we've gotten soft, and I think that will, that trickles into combat sports. It's for the nature of it. It's very primal. I mean,
but do you see like the people who like are just like a softer generation? I just don't see those people like finding their way to martial arts, MMA, any of that kind of stuff.
Once, if you think about it like this and look at all sports, if you remember back to the NBA, these guys were getting in fist fights, punching each other in the face. You think about how hard NFL used to be. Think about the Johnny Unitas era and those eras. I don't know if I'm dating myself. Remember Johnny Unitas?
Oh, yeah. I know. Yeah.
So if you think about that era and then move on to the Lawrence Taylor era and then look at where things are now, rules have changed. I mean, I think overall,
I hear that
faster. The athletes might be more athletic, you know, the plays might be more spectacular, but that sort of hardened, like manly man thing is starting to go.
Just mean motherfuckers.
Mean motherfuckers that are really out there trying to rip your fucking head off. I don't even know if you could have the steel curtain anymore. You know, they probably would be
fine. They'd be arrested, Coach.
They would be arrested. Absolutely. I mean, what was the running back? The Moose.
Love the Moose, man. That was my nickname from him. Coach called me the Moose.
The Moose. He couldn't play. I mean, they were. If you look back at that era, they were men playing manly sports. And I think what's happening, even in combat sports, everything is just is generation. We are getting softer, which is another reason why I enjoyed living in Thailand in the jungle, because I still think because it has that gladiatorial feel. You're sure. Around being around hard things, and because personally, I hope I'm dead and gone before this world goes completely soft and into the shitter. That's why I searched out places like that, because I thrive in those type of Spartan, those harder conditions. I mean, even I'll tell you a cool story of Thailand to kind of prove my point. I was working when I retired. My last fight was a pretty good fight, and they gave me a job off of it. And I ended up working, and my boss was a really, really good man. He was a politician. So there's going to be two parts of this story. Now, allegedly, he assassinated another politician. I got here. Yeah, he allegedly assassinated another politician. That kind of put a little bit of a damper on things, but he should be out soon.
What?
He had a deal with Sing Pathanun Prison. So I was a commentator. So the prisoners would actually come and fight on our show. We had shows 7 days a week. I worked 4 days a week. And they would come and the CO would corner them. If they did well, they could get their freedom. You had things like what's called prison fights, where you could literally fight your way out of prison. You could, you know, there was a famous movie made, and one of the guys in there, he had, you know, killed a bunch of people, but then he lost prison fights. He was a teenager. They thought he threw a fight. So what in Thailand, Asian culture is called losing face. So nobody would deal with him. He kind of shamed his family, was shamed, everything. So he didn't know what to do. He had no way to make money, so he ended up becoming like a hitman for a mob. And so he ends up going to jail for several murders or assassinations. And he loses prison fight 1 year, wins it the next year, and then gets his freedom. I used to see him all the time. Nice guy. Became a mob. He would actually corner another guy because one of our champions on Max was a prisoner. He won one of our, we have called the weekday belts. For our global show, and he eventually got his freedom. So you can fight your way out of prison.
If you're like one of the best fighters in the country, you basically have a get out of jail free card in your back pocket.
You'd be surprised how many good fighters there are now. Now things are starting to change because now with the internet, social media, it's a little harder now. Because before, yeah, you could disappear somebody and when I say the term big boss, a lot of it is, for instance, when I was fighting in Lumpini, the original Lumpini, it's run by the military. So you can have no facial hair. And it's really crazy because even if you were Muslim, you had to shave your, no matter what, you had to shave your face. There was no facial hair. If you had long hair, you had to cut it. You had to wear the shorts of the sponsor. The military ran it. It was military run by the generals. Instead of like an athletic commission, there's a general that oversees the sport, but there's no, like nobody checks your hand wraps. And even in when I was fighting the Lumpini, mouthpieces were only, they were only mandatory for round one. After that, you didn't have to wear it no more. So if things have changed now, even now things are getting, softer, but yeah, I forget where I was going with this, but
I don't know.
You could essentially fight your way out of prison. We had a deal where the prisoners would actually come to us, so we would Sing Pathanun Prison, the boss of the show. Oh, I was saying about the bosses, the big bosses, like either it was a family owned gym or they were somehow military run. Like I know the founder, one of the gyms, Sit Won Chai, the brother is one of the big police chiefs. The father was like a general, great man. He was like 70, 80 years old, get up, would run around in a circle. He was just like great shape. And how can I say it? Like there's an element of underworld, but there's also, you know, which makes it kind of like cool a little bit, I guess.
It really cool.
You realize how absolutely absurd this sounds to a normal American, right?
Oh, really? Well, I'll tell you what. Let me tell you like this. Without saying anything, I worked and at a gym before with honest working people, support, you know, making their money legally. Biggest piece of shit scumbags I've ever met in my life. Unethical piece of shit. Drake, you might know what I'm talking about. We don't have to say no names. It's nightless. Piece of shit human beings.
Piece of shit.
And they're, by all intents and purposes, law-abiding citizens like this. Absolute piece of shit. Didn't have a set of balls between them, right? Now, in Thailand, I've been in camps where the guy was a gangster. I worked for guys who are, like I told you a story about the boss at Max. Some of the most fair. Now we're talking about, you know, in turn of honorable to us, to me, to people. I remember I wasn't trying to be a gangster, so I wasn't in their world. Sure. I wanted to stay in my lane. Never had a problem. Straight shooters, told you exactly how it was, things like that. So there is a very interesting, you know, dynamic with saying that.
Sure.
I never
surprised. The honorable criminal.
In a lot of ways, you'd be very surprised. I mean, if you they like fighting. They understand there's a sort of underworld component to it. Now, were they all gangsters? No, but I mean, if you were dealing, I've dealt in situations where I've worked for them from there to. I mean, I don't want to, you know, say too much, but worked around a lot in this fight world because there is a relationship between gangsters and fighting. It's always been, even going back to the Italian mob and boxing and
sure.
Bush mob and boxing. I mean, it's always been there. And I can say, you know, like, so that right there kind of says, we look at one side like they're politicians who should be in fucking jail.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I get what
you're saying. I hear you.
Who should be in fucking jail for committing.
Most of them should be in fucking jail.
Right, for committing, you know what I mean, for
all the shit that they do.
Exactly. Now, I have, you know, so we know what is, you know, the laws change every day. You know, tomorrow someone could pass a law saying wearing a black and red shirt is illegal. I'm now become a criminal overnight. So what I'm saying is say that, like, it was an interesting working for those type of people and being a fighter for them because I've never had a problem with them. And in actuality, like, what's talking about the boss on my show was a politician, not saying he was a gangster by any sorts, but they treat you very fairly. I know, for instance, for one instance, when I actually, I remember before my last fight, I had broke my arm in an underground fight. I guess I'll probably go into that story for you guys to give you another thing, which I think is normal, but there was a fighter where the king had passed in Thailand. And so all fights had been canceled. And I was at a camp in Bangkok. I was training to get a fight. I had a sponsor in Australia. He had sent me to this camp. Australia has a very, very high level of Muay Thai. And because they're in such close proximity to Thailand. So he was sponsoring me. And I went to the camp. I was in Bangkok training for a fight. Ironically, on the show Max Muay Thai, which I later ended up working for. And I remember when the king passed away, all fights in the country got shut down. I was running out of money. Just so happened, someone said, hey, there's an underground fight. You know, do you want to take? I said, come on, man, I'm on the way. So I had just enough money to go from Bangkok on like an 18-hour bus ride to the south to take the fight. And I remember breaking my arm, well, fracturing my forearm in this fight. It was really funny because they were kind of like line people up. They're like, guy smoke a cigarette, you come out, you come out. I'm looking at my guy like, man, this motherfucker's not in my weight class. What are you doing? So I'm a fraction. This is weird. It's like a curse almost. Five people on that night got their arm broke. I was a sixth fighter. I got my fraction. It was the weirdest thing. So I remember, so later on, so fast forward, I go to where I'm working. I'm going to have my last fight at Max. So my arm refractured in the training. So I'm actually, I don't want to pull out of the fight. I'm like, there's no way I'm pulling out, you know, because I didn't want my boss to lose face because, you know, they were a good, really nice family. And they really took care of me. And I could see he felt bad. I was like, man, like, look, don't worry. You know, I'm taking this motherfucking fight, man. You know, we got to fucking duct tape this motherfucking arm. If it pops out the bone, we just gonna duct tape that shit and keep going. And I remember going to see the boss to save face, like the boss of the promotion, Max. He said, he was like, look, don't worry. If your arm breaks or whatever happens, I'll pay for it. He's like, so fight with courage. And I went out there and I had a I guess impressive fight. I mean, a lot of people saw it. And he would do that for a lot of people. He would pay for guys. I know guys that would get injured, break their hand, or one guy I know he got all his teeth knocked out. He would pay for this out of pocket. And
that's awesome.
So that's when I think about it. And that would be a lot of these guys that, you know, we would consider, you know, quote unquote, like I said, maybe bad people.
Sure.
So I'm around people to consider.
But they had a code, right? They had a code that they lived their life by.
They have. I've come to realize sometimes these gangsters have more of a code than law-abiding citizens. And I think back to the last gym, to a gym I was working at, where they were the most unethical pussy-hearted people I've ever met. Unbelievable to me how they look themselves in the mirror to think that, damn, I've been around gangsters who had more of a sense of honor and integrity.
Yeah.
While living in Southeast Asia.
Sure. Yeah.
The biggest thing that I'm pulling out of this, Kevin, is that when Drake does disappear,
he's in Thailand.
We know where he's at.
He's in Thailand.
It's Thailand.
He'll actually like it. Drake, you got to come over there because jiu-jitsu, especially in the South now, Phuket, jiu-jitsu is really starting to, it's becoming like an almost like a mecca now because when you have, you know, the climate is great and you're seeing a lot of jiu-jitsu gyms pop up. I mean, Phuket now, I'd say South Florida is the mecca for MMA. Phuket, Thailand is the international hot spot for people to go train. All these MMA fighters are, remember my buddy Phil Haas?
Oh, I know Phil Haas.
Yeah. Phil's, he's over there now.
I heard that.
A lot of these UFC guys are starting to go over there now. Your money goes a lot further. Your quality of life is better. You know, obviously your training, is easy access for bodies and stuff like that. So the money that you actually make from your fighting, you can actually put away, invest in things like that. And let's just say for Thailand, if you do it right and provide you're getting training, it's not unheard of. You could live off of $12,000 for a year, could carry you for a year.
Oh, that's shit. So insane.
Maybe we'll all move over there.
Yeah, I mean,
you might fuck around and move to Thailand.
You'll live very, very well. I mean, and you know, you're talking about some of the most beautiful beaches. And the one thing, while I say all these other crazy, the stories that you hear me say, and like, I mean, I didn't go too far down the rabbit hole for you guys with some of these stories because they go deep down.
I'd love to.
I gave PG versions best I could. The one beautiful thing about Thailand is that, and this is what I say, as a foreigner, if you get into problems with another Thai, with a Thai, it's 99.9% your fault because the Thais are very non-confrontational. They'll have their beefs or their things amongst each other, whatever their things are. But for the most part, as long as you don't try and get involved in their world, they're not running. For instance, I had an apartment and girl I was dating at the time, I was back actually for one of Matt's camps. So I was thinking I was here for maybe 6 weeks. She left something on my door because she didn't realize what time I had left. She was away herself. So when she had got back, I had already gone. So she left something on my door and it was a pair of gloves, money, and like in a bag. So it would have been on there for about 5.5 weeks. When I came back, it was still there. There's a certain code. You're not going to have people out here trying to rob you. It's a very, very safe place. The one thing you have to understand is you have to, at all points, at all times, you're surrounded by conflict, meaning that in the northern, I think it's the northern part, you're near the Golden Triangle, what's considered the infamous Golden Triangle with the opium and the heroin.
Good.
Myanmar, which borders Myanmar, it used to be Burma when I was younger. It's now Myanmar. They have a conflict going on in the southern part of Thailand, which is northern Malaysia, southern Thailand. They have their own conflict because they want to be their own Islamic state. If you want, I can go into a little story about that one.
Absolutely. Hit us.
I had a fight called Thai Fights, and it was in a place called Plattani, Thailand, which is in that area I was talking about. So Malaysia's Islamic country, and that area wants to be so northern Malaysia, southern Thailand. They want to be their own sort of Islamic state, and it's in the jungle, beautiful place. So there was a first time to show Thai Fights. It was a huge show, real popular. A lot of the best Thais versus foreigners are fighting on there. So I was offered to fight on there. Never been down there before. And I remember there was no Air Force base. So we had to leave from the Royal Thai Air Force base on them like a military plane. And the people at the camp would always tell me, like, the Thai was like, oh, yeah, their bombs blow up all the time there. They're like laughing. And it's funny. It's like Thais don't have a word for extreme, right? So no matter what, it's always die. So if you're sick, they're like, oh, me think you die, sure. Like everything is die. If you're getting beat up bad, like, oh, why you die, man? Like, there's no word for extreme. It's just die. So
wow.
We flew on the plane, we get down there. They have the Humvees and with the gun turrets and, you know, and then the vans, and then they have motorcycles circling us. And I remember going in there and into the hotel, and I was like, man, I can't get any service. I had like a funny little, like a brick Nokia phone. I was like, I don't get any service. I'm like, yeah, yeah, well, we turned it off because, you know, the other week, somebody blew up a hotel and things like that. I was like, yeah, what the fuck, man? So we fought in a soccer stadium with, it was like under a military thing. So you would see the signs we were riding. It was a hand with a circle around it and something right underneath of it. And what they were saying was, please stop the roadside bombings. And so and it's one of my favorite, most memorable experiences. I love going down there.
Where all the roadside bombings are happening.
It was in a soccer stadium. It was 55,000 people. It was a sea of people. And I loved it. I felt unsafe as shit, but I loved it. I was trying to go back. It was incredible. So that was like Patani. So I was saying to say that at all times, Thailand surrounded by conflict. But inside of Thailand, it's very, very peaceful in terms of, you know, as long as you act with like anywhere else. If you act with respect to people and everything, you won't have any problems. It's also
like on the larger scale of things, there's conflict all over the country. But like on a microcosm, you're walking down the street in the city, you're going to be safe.
Well, no, in the surrounding countries, there's conflict. Inside of there, you know, it's relatively safe unless you're in the southern part, you know. But, you know, there are things that happen because, yes, like everywhere in the world, there's gangsters, there's underworld, there's all that stuff. But, you know, for the most part, it's safe. Like I've been in two of the coups where they took over, the military took over. Didn't bother me. I mean, I didn't like, I actually flew back into one of the coups, man, had a fight. And then I remember his wife was saying like, oh, the news, there's a coup in Thailand. What are you doing? What do you want to do? I said, look, man, is the fucking plane going aboard? I said, then I'm gone. I'm going down.
Holy smokes.
As long as they still allow fighting, man, that's all you need to know.
I was like, I didn't give a fuck if they didn't allow fighting. I was like, look, I'm going back to where the action is, man. That's my home. I'm flying back there. As long as the ball, I was like, my whole thing was, I just need the plane to land. Once it lands, I'll figure out the rest, man. I mean, I'll navigate my way through the rest of it.
So would you feel safer walking down the street and most of the cities in Thailand versus like some of the rough areas in DC, Baltimore?
Yes. And you mean in Thailand?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm not concerned about getting robbed or the things like that or some stray bullet hit me in the head. Like, you know, over there, like I will say this, when there are certain gangster things that happen, they pretty much get who they need to get without going too far into it. It's not going to be like a lot of running.
So they got better gangsters over there is what you're telling us.
They're efficient.
Yeah, if you're the target, they're going to get the target. Where here, you know, they're liable to, you know, there's no aim. These guys, you know, they just shoot indiscriminately, very sociopathic with this. I would feel much safer in Asia. The only place I felt nervous would have been the Philippines. And I love the Philippines. It's my favorite place to fight, to go. I love the Philippines. But in Manila, it can get a little
sketchy.
Unsafe in certain places because they have so many guns down there. They make guns there. But in terms of everything else, Filipino people are some of the nicest people I've had, even though some of my best story, craziest stories have been in the Philippines, like being extorted, being on a plane where the engine blew up and had to make an emergency landing. Aside from that, I love the Philippines. Fucking love it.
Brother, you've had some interesting life experiences, I gotta say.
Philippines, man. It is beautiful.
You are not going to have many regrets when they put you in the ground.
No, but that's the life I want to live. We only get to just go around this thing once here. So yeah, hey.
I'm low key jealous, man. I'm low key jealous that I think I got to go with Philippines and Thailand and just spend some time over there.
Go over there, man. Look, there's nothing special about me. I'm a regular person. Anything I've done, anybody can do. Well, there's nothing special. It's harder to do what you guys did than to do what I did.
No,
I don't know.
No,
NFL playing Division One, you know what I mean? As you know, it's just what I did. It's not that difficult. You just have to have a good pair of balls and some heart, and you can do it, and a willingness.
It's a good. That's a good way to live life. I think I know this. You've given us a lot of your time tonight, and I appreciate it a lot. Drake, if you have anything else you want to bring up or talk about, go for it. Otherwise, Dorian,
I told you that he was going to melt your guys' brain.
Yeah, we're going to have to have him back. We're going to have to have you that you had series.
I promised you that you had no idea what was coming, and I fucking knew it. Coach, you knocked it out of the park, man. You're about to gain a lot of fans out of the Midwest United States that you didn't know were coming, because you just blew a lot of people's minds.
Midwest resident. She's from Columbus, Ohio. I love the Midwest.
Yeah,
it's a good place.
And most of our fans ain't gonna love Columbus, Ohio, but we'll.
The Hawkeyes don't like the Buckeyes, huh?
No.
Well, they don't like us as much, man. We shitted in their Cheerios not too long ago.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Really? How about
they got us back. They got us
back.
Yeah, but they're
supposed to get us back. They've still not recovered from the one that we gave them.
It's probably true.
Bad recruiting year. We talking about football here, because the wrestling is kind of always neck and neck here.
Yeah. That's a good wrestling rivalry, too. Probably two of the top five programs in the country.
How's the football looking? Ohio State was always like all the teams I remember coming up, it has shifted.
So our senior year, they came into Kinnick and we beat them 55-24.
Wow.
Hung a 50 burger on them.
Nice.
We caught them on a hell of a day. Nowadays they pretty much run the show in the Big Ten. And always compete nationally.
It's been Michigan last couple of years, but
well, yeah. That's true.
Are they in the Big Ten? They didn't move to the the ACC teams moved to the Big Ten, right?
Couple.
Wasn't it Maryland?
Yeah. Maryland and Rutgers.
Did. Rutgers.
Yeah. Are they getting smoked? Because I always wondered how an ACC
team. They are. Yes, they are getting shitted on.
Yeah, I would think they don't have the completely different game. They're not ready to handle that type of Big Ten type of game.
Correct. Correct. There's probably about 1,000 different directions that I could take this, but that's my time for tonight. We'll have you back sometime, Dorian. This was fucking awesome.
I tried to keep it PG for you guys, and I hope I did a good job.
Next time we'll
phenomenal. Yeah. I was absolutely loving it watching these guys' reactions, because I've heard some of these stories. Some of them are new stories, but I had the idea of what was coming, and they had no idea. They just learned about a whole different side of Earth that none of them knew existed. And there's going to be thousands of people who are going to have the exact same experience. So very, very much a pleasure to listen to that one.
Thank you. I hope I kept it humble enough, man.
You're fantastic. Pleasure meeting you, and thank you again for your time. For everyone that listened, the thousands of people Drake just mentioned, I hope you had an entertaining time that I did during this.
Dude, that was epic.
And we will talk to you guys again on the next show. Until then, peace. Hey, thanks for listening to the show. If you want more, you can check us out on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube by searching Washed Up Walk-Ons. And if you're interested in supporting the show, head over to patreon.com/washedupwalkons, where you can find bonus podcasts, merchandise, and other cool perks. Best part, half of your subscription benefits the kids at UI Children's Hospital. We'll see you next time. Hawks by a million.